Retired Marine Corps General John Kelly stepped down as President Trump's chief of staff at the end of 2018 after more than a year spent managing the daily operations inside the West Wing. Kelly spent most of his entire adult life serving the nation. He wore a Marine uniform for more than 40 years. He was briefly retired before joining the Trump administration.
In June, General Kelly spoke with David Rubenstein, co-founder of the Carlyle Group and host of the Bloomberg television show Peer-to-Peer Conversations.
So let's talk about first what it was like to be chief of staff to President Trump. Was it all that you thought it would be in terms of the difficulty, more difficult than you thought, and you're pleased you did the job?
It was certainly amongst the hardest jobs I've ever had in my life, but I would say this as well after as much time as I had in the military. It was the most important thing I ever did. For 18 months, I staffed the president the way I think a president should be staffed, presenting him options, presenting him, getting the experts in with him to talk and hash things out. That's what a chief of staff does. That was vitally important. And for 18 months I was there, I think we staffed the president very effectively.
So was it the hardest job you ever had? The most memorable job, the most enjoyable job, or just another very interesting job?
No, it was very, very hard, but very meaningful, not very enjoyable. But, you know, I mean, it's staffing the President of the United States. I mean, you're trying to bring together not only a White House staff, but the entire federal government to help him make the kind of decisions, whether it's economic decisions, social decisions, or, you know, life and death, wartime decisions.
In Washington, it's often said that people stab you in the back, but also sometimes they stab you in the front. And that's the job that often the chief of staff is said to have. You get, you know, criticized by everybody. So did you feel that the criticism by people or the attacks on you just for any reason was something that was unfair or not tolerable, or you just got used to it?
Yeah, I would tell you I wasn't used to, one of the things that struck me right away that I was not used to coming out of the military was the intense personal ambition that people have. And because if that gets out of hand, which I think it was out of hand certainly before my time, and it continued a bit while I was there, people start to do things like leak to the press, things that are untrue or half true, not just towards people at the top like me, but their colleagues. One of the things I did very early on when I took over at the White House was get all of the staff together, and there's a lot of them, so I had to do several sessions, and just said, nowhere in the oath of office that you take to, you know, support and defend the Constitution of the United States, nowhere in there does it say that you should be talking to the press unless that's part of your job and authorized. Nowhere does it say you should be stabbing your colleagues in the back so that you'll look better. You serve the nation, and if you take the oath seriously, you got a job and I want you to stay. If you can't do that, find another place to work.
When you're in the military and you tell people you do X, Y, or Z, they jump or they're in trouble or they're going to be court-martialed or something. When you tell people as a chief of staff that they should do X, Y, or Z and they don't do it, what can you really do about it?
Well, let me go back to your original statement. In the military, if you tell someone to do X, Y, or Z, we expect people to question orders or to push back. So, I mean, I can't, as a commander, know everything. In the White House, you're right, there's not, I mean, you can fire people. I mean, I had to fire a few people, but very, very few. And they were very disruptive. But I had good people. The vast majority of the people, David, that work there are good people. They just need some direction.
So when Donald Trump was elected, you were already retired from the military?
I'd retired from the military about 8 months at that point, never wanting to work again.
Okay, and did you know Donald Trump at any point before?
Not in any way.
Elected? So did you met him in the transition, I assume?
I received a phone call in late November on a Saturday, they asked me if I wouldn't consider coming up to Bedminster to meet with the president-elect and talk to him about going into the administration. My wife, after the phone call, asked me, you know, what was that all about? And I explained to her, and I said, what do you think? She said, well, you know, if we're nothing else as a family, we're a family of service, so why don't you go up and at least talk to them? And so I went up the next day to Bedminster, talked to the president-elect. Reince Priebus was there and a couple of other people. We had a short chit-chat, but 10 days later, he asked me to come up to New York City to Trump Tower, went up there, and he offered me the DHS job.
And did you say, I accept right on the spot? And did you feel you really wanted to go in that job?
Well, again, I know up to that point in time, certainly no other way. You know, my lifestyle was service to the nation. Obviously, I had to get out of the Marine Corps. I was getting too old and whatnot. But the opportunity to serve was something I really looked forward to. And DHS was a great job. The men and women at DHS are just phenomenal patriots, and they're really unsung heroes.
So you did that job for how long before you became chief of staff?
Right at 6 months. I left the job on the 31st of July.
Well, did the president call you a few times before and say, I don't like my chief of staff, I'm going to make a change? How did you get asked to do the chief of staff job?
It was a couple of days before it was announced. During my time at DHS, I didn't go to the White House a lot, didn't need to. Most cabinet people are busy doing what they do. But he and I had a previous discussion on a couple of things that relative to the staff. Anyways, he called me and said, hey, I really would like you to come on over and be the chief of staff. I need your kind of leadership to put this place in a direction.
My wife wouldn't want me to do this. It's a terrible job. I don't want to do this.
I really like DHS. The people were making a difference. An awful lot of your agenda is wrapped up in DHS. But he said, I really need you to do this. So I did it. Okay. President asked, I did it.
Well, I'd like to talk about the job you did as chief of staff. Before that, I'd like to talk about your background. So where are you originally from?
I grew up in Boston.
And your family was a blue-collar family?
Very, very, very blue-collar.
So your
father? Dad was a World War II vet. He worked two jobs his whole life, mailman and railroad. Greatest man I ever knew.
So you went to high school where?
St. Mary's High School, just outside of Boston.
And when you graduated, what did you do?
I went to almost a year of college. I graduated in 1968, the war was on. Coming from the kind of neighborhood I came from, I mean, every man in my life growing up as a boy was either a World War II vet or a Korean War vet. That's all they talked about. And so, we had a draft back then. It was relatively easy to get out of the draft. I mean, you just had to come in with a doctor's note or go to college. You know, a lot of deferments. I didn't want to get out. And so when I passed my draft physical, which would have brought me into the Army, like most of the guys in my neighborhood, went in the Marine Corps.
Are you entered the Marine Corps and you became a lieutenant, or what was your...
No, I became a private. Well, I went from private to private first class. Ultimately, I made sergeant. I was an infantryman, made sergeant. My mother was diagnosed with cancer, so I got out of the Marine Corps, but stayed in a program that continued my training while I was going to college. And as soon as I graduated from college, University of Massachusetts in Boston, I got commissioned, went back in the Marine Corps, and stayed forever. And
so the highest you can become, really, is a four-star general.
Four-star, right.
And you became a four-star general?
I became a four-star.
Did you ever expect when you were just beginning in the Marine Corps you'd be a four-star general?
No. I mean, when I was an enlisted Marine, I wanted to be hopefully a NCO someday, that's corporal. I made sergeant, best rank I ever held.
Okay, so you're in the Marine Corps, and as you rise up, eventually one of your assignments is to go into Iraq after the invasion in 2003. So you were in combat, and did you expect that you would survive? It was fairly dangerous?
Well, it is dangerous. I mean, there's a lot of shooting and bombs and whatnot, but we're Marines, and you take that on as a possibility. But we were, you know, when we were designing the campaign plan, one of the things we did was to, understand the Iraqi army was nothing, is even close to us. But we designed a strategy that would minimize the amount of damage to the country and the amount of death to the Iraqi army. We went there, and our mindset was that we were not there to conquer them, but to liberate them. So we didn't want to kill a lot of them. And I mean the army. Obviously, you'd always try to not kill the
civilians. But did the Marine Corps and the army going in think it would all be over in 1 or 2 weeks and that people would be cheering you?
Well, they were cheering us, which was almost everywhere we went. They came out in huge numbers. But the attack part of it, I mean, was easy. We knew we were going to win. We were going to get to Baghdad in lightning time. But what we kept asking in the Kuwait desert leading up to the invasion in March was, who's going to take this over from us? You know, Mr. Rumsfeld had come out very strongly and said, we, the U.S. military, is not going to get involved in nation building. And our question was, okay, who are we going to turn that over to? Because we should start thinking about that now. And so the idea that we were going to leave quickly, which we military did start to do, but not have anyone to turn it over, it was really, that was, had, caused us great concern as military men.
So did men working for you get killed under you?
Oh, yeah.
And so what do you do in that situation? You send a letter to the next of kin, or how do you deal with that emotionally?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's part of the lifestyle. It's not an easy part of the lifestyle. You know, when I was a commander there, when I went back for a subsequent tour, I was the senior Marine commander on the ground, and there were a lot of things that you might list that you would be woken up for in the middle of the night. And I only had two of them. A missing American, because then we had to go to general quarters to find that person, and then a death. And people would say, why did you want to get woken up on the deaths? There's nothing you can do. I said, well, I think I owe the Marine, sailor, soldier, and their family at least to be woken up and for someone to tell me this young man, this young woman just died in the defense of their country.
Let's talk about after you retired for a while, before you joined the Trump administration, you were in the business world, or what were you doing?
Not very much. I started working with the National Defense University, which is part of DOD. And then I just started to get a couple of opportunities to be on boards. I joined those boards, but almost as soon as I joined them, I was disengaging because I was in the process of going to DHS.
All right, so you're on some corporate boards for the first time. You're making more money than presumably you made in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, not huge money,
but
more than the Marine Corps.
All right, but so going back in the government, it was actually another cut in salary, but your
was,
family
yeah.
didn't say anything about that, I
right.
guess. They were happy
with it. What was interesting, going into DHS, I was about $50,000 more than I made a year as a four-star. And then what I didn't know, and my wife said to me after a couple of weeks being at the White House, she said, I think our pay is wrong because the paycheck is quite a bit smaller. I didn't realize I took a pretty major pay cut to be the chief of staff.
You didn't ask the president what
Never
the pay
asked.
Was?
Money's not relevant. Right.
So let's talk about your family for a moment. When you're a four-star, you're often traveling all over the place. So your wife gets to travel with you in some of your assignments or not. How many different places did you have to move as a general?
Well, when I was, my wife, she loved that question. When I was in Miami, my wife went to Guantanamo Bay for 3 years so we could have Thanksgiving dinner with the troops down there at the detention facility. I took her to Haiti. I took her to Honduras once, maybe twice, maybe Honduras and Guatemala, one each, and then once to Peru.
What about Paris or London?
No,
none of that.
No.
And so you have three children.
Mm-hmm.
You father three children.
Right.
Your oldest son is in the military still?
He's a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, fairly recently promoted, just back from one of his tours from in Iraq.
And you have a daughter?
Daughter.
And what is she doing?
Well, she was with the FBI. Prior to that, actually, she worked with the wounded men and women, mostly men coming back from the wars, at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And then she went into the FBI. She was with the hostage rescue team as one of the support people for several years.
And you have another son who lost his life in military combat.
That's right. He was started off as an enlisted Marine and then became a second lieutenant and was killed in Afghanistan.
And did you and your wife say having two sons in the Marines is an awful sacrifice for any family?
No, it's our way of life. That may sound strange to the listeners, but it is a way of life, and they make their own decisions.
What would you say is the best training to be chief of staff at the White House, and particularly yeah. with President Trump? What do you think is the best training?
Well, I think one, you've got to tell the boss the truth. When you don't think he's going down the right road, not in front of a bunch of people, but when you don't think he's going down the right road, to tell him that. Truth to power.
Right.
Someone in the room has got to say, at the beginning of every conversation and at the end, is this good for America?
So let's go forward now to chief of staff. So you're the chief of staff, sounds like a good title. Everybody, presumably in the government, is responsive to you. You can call any cabinet secretary and tell them what to do. Is that the way it works?
I would not say I'd tell them what to do. I'd suggest, I mean, they are cabinet members. You know, the president puts out, as you know, I mean, you don't, whether it's tweets or just his time with the press, and he does a lot of discussion with the press, he puts out his feelings on different things. More often than not, I would get calls from the cabinet people saying, hey, I just heard him say this. Is that a change? Should we react to it? So the president is never hesitant to pick up the phone and talk to his own cabinet members and
whatnot. Did you ever say to the president, maybe the tweets are too much to keep up with, or maybe you shouldn't tweet as much?
Never did. The president feels very, very strongly, whether you agree with this or not, very strongly that he's not dealt with by the press fairly, and that his tweeting goes around the press and gets his agenda out, his word out to the world without having to rely on a press conference.
Now, let's talk about a few substantive issues. Early in the administration, when you were at the Department of Homeland Security, there was the issue of immigration, the ban on immigration, mm-hmm. and so forth. Were you alerted to that when you were there? And how do you think that ultimately is now working out?
Just a couple of 3 days after I became the DHS secretary, the EO came out on the so-called travel ban. And, you know, as a sidebar, I would say that the countries and the seven countries involved in the president's thinking were all dysfunctional. You know, I mean, Iran, you know, everyone knows it's a hotbed of terrorism. The other countries were dysfunctional. The entire population, Muslim population of those countries added up to about 11% of the world's population. The point is, those countries, they don't have a process that we could bless and say, the people that they say are coming out of those countries to come to the United States for whatever reason, there's no way to really tell who they are because these countries are in a state of collapse. It could have been done better. Back to, David, the staff process. If that had been when I was there, say several months later, the idea that the president might want to do that, and he has strong feelings on immigration, we all know that, we'd have run that through this process and at least had a better release plan.
When you were at the White House, you also had the wall issue. The president really wanted to build a wall. You were quoted a few times as saying, well, it doesn't have to be a concrete wall, it can be see-through or something like that. Was there a difference between you and the president on that? And do you think the wall is a good policy?
When I got the DHS, I went to the experts, the Customs and Border Protection people that man, you know, the bastion down there, that man the watchtower on the, and said, do we need a wall? And they said, or some physical barrier. The university said, we need more. We have, remember, back in, I think, 2006, the Congress authorized over 650 miles of wall. And Senators Clinton, Schumer, and Obama all voted for it. So that was in 2006, 650 miles. What the CVP people were telling me is, we want to improve that barrier. And we can give you, if you tell me I can get 300 more miles, I can tell you exactly where to put it. If you tell me I can have 1,000 more miles, I'll tell you exactly where I want it. They also said that we want to be able to see through the wall because we want to be able to track what's going on the other side. And just as importantly, according to them, and they're the experts, we want the people that are contemplating jumping the wall to see us because if they see us, they don't do it.
Now, he had a meeting twice. He met twice with the leader of North Korea. Did you think that was a good idea to meet without advance preparation about what would happen? And do you think the policy of meeting actually usually works, or you should always have advance preparation when you have these summit meetings?
Well, there's a lot of advance preparation. I mean, there's a lot of advance preparation, a lot of letters back and forth. People at state and other places have their contacts there. But I'll applaud the president in that he looked back on the last, I don't know, 70 years of trying to deal with the North Korean leadership, and none of that was working. And he's the kind of guy I grew to know that wanted to have a try it personally. So I'll pick the phone up and talk to the guy, or I want to meet with him and try to develop a relationship. And that's who he is. But I think many times it was, all the other stuff hasn't worked for 70 years. What the heck, let's give it a try.
Some people would say the president was very reluctant to criticize Putin for anything, and he seemed overly friendly with him compared to other presidents. You think that's a fair comment, and why do you think it was?
Well, the explanation is much like with Kim. I mean, things had not been working very well over the last 8, 10, 35 years. And he is, you know, he's a pick the phone up and talk to the guy kind of guy.
Was it complicated to have the president's family in the government at the time?
They're an influence that has to be dealt with.
And today, if you were...
Mrs. Trump. First Lady's a wonderful person.
If you had to advise somebody who's going to be a chief of staff in the future, what would you say is the best training to be chief of staff at the White House? And particularly with President Trump, what do you think is the best training?
Well, I think, one, you've got to tell the boss the truth. When you don't think he's going down the right road, not in front of a bunch of people, but when you don't think he's going down the right road, to tell him that. Truth to power.
Right.
Someone in the room has got to say, at the beginning of every conversation and at the end, is this good for America?
So when you told the president in private, I think you should do something different than you want to do, did he like yell or does he
We'd have a discussion on it and say, more often than not, he'd say, okay, let's bring them back in.
So if you had to do it all over again, would you have taken the job of chief of staff, or are you glad you took that job?
Well, again, I was drafted into the job.
But knowing everything now know.
Yes. As hard as it was I feel very strongly, for 18 months, I don't know what's happened since, but for 18 months, President Donald J. Trump, on every issue, was well-staffed, was well-informed. We gave him options. Well, I'll just leave it at that.
So as you look back on your career, what would you say you're most proud of having achieved? And did your parents live to see you become a general?
My dad did. Many things. I would say what did I achieve? For over 40 years, I served the nation in peace and war. Goes without saying, I'm most proud of my family and my kids. But for over nearly 45 years, served the nation in peace and war, served it honorably with integrity.
So do you consider yourself retired, or are you going to be active in the business world?
I don't know how to retire.
So what do you plan to spend most of your time doing?
No idea what I'm going to do, but I don't know how to retire.
Do you consider the highest calling of mankind private equity? Not sure about that.
Not sure about that, David.
That was former White House Chief of Staff General John Kelly.